Welcome to Geeks Who Lead, the global learning community for senior data and engineering leaders operating at scale. My name's Peter Bale. I'm founder and CTO at Geeks Who Lead, and previously taught at Columbia Business School and ran engineering at General Assembly. The future of engineering leadership is here. It's just not evenly distributed. Every week, we share interviews from senior data and engineering leaders, sharing their hard-won wisdom. And occasionally, we mix it up with interviews with domain experts who can help us all to more effectively deliver business values from the engineering or data orgs that we oversee. Today, I'm speaking with Aviv Ben-Yosef, who is a technical executive consultant. Aviv, thanks so much for taking the time to talk today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Now, I know that you're running your own consulting shop, but it seems to be like you've worked with a number of bigger companies over the years.
Yeah, I work with companies through the entire range, from day-old startups all the way up to more established and more senior sorts of organizations, such as Oracle and Chegg for public companies and other unicorns, mostly in the Israeli area, like Riskified, Armis, Big Panda, and others.
Got it. And when we were talking earlier, the story that really captured my attention was based upon some of your experiences earlier in your career in the Israeli military. So what for you was, or what was your role there, and what for you made that an interesting experience?
Yeah, so I served at a relatively small subunit that's sort of like the Israeli equivalent of the NSA. And I got enlisted, as one does here, when I turned 18. And my role initially was just the role of a software engineer. We didn't use the term software engineers. We were all just programmers. And things were less fancy back then. And when I started, I used to work mainly on high volume. Again, high volume for the beginning of the millennium. Things have moved since then. But high volume systems, distributed systems, mostly in Java and Python. And we had a bunch of fun there when it comes to learning extremely fast. And we talked about this, and I think this is one of the main things that have shaped my entire trajectory, my entire career. And that is that I got there as an 18-year-old with virtually no experience prior. I mean, I taught myself how to code, but you get there. I've never worked with anyone face-to-face. It was basically my first time seeing someone else coding. And right off the bat, like after a couple of months of training, we were given responsibility on systems that were responsible to get live intelligence data for the Israeli forces. As in, if you have a bug, if the system is down, if there's an outage, we might be missing a notice that, you know, can stop a potential terror attack, that sort of stuff. And it was real. It's not another SaaS system that if it's down, there's a status page, we wait, it's fine, someone tweets. No, this is serious stuff. And we were 18-year-old. And what I really, really grokked only years later was the fact that this is something that most of us don't get to experience in our careers. We rarely get this sort of responsibility so early. And I saw how it really propelled everyone around me to learn so much faster, because we knew what was at stake. We knew that we had to learn fast or something bad just might happen. And, you know, of course we had bugs. Of course we had outages. It's not NASA. But still, we got things working really, really fast. We learned really, really fast. And I think that this is something that we can all try and learn from. That's partly what I've been trying to recreate with my clients throughout these years.
Which is fascinating to me, because the traditional narrative is like, look, you don't want somebody with less than, if they're coming out of a boot camp computer science program, you want them to season for maybe 2 to 5 years, then it's, you're going to be able to go faster, you're going to get more velocity in the team, and that you've got to be very careful about your ratio of, say, senior, let's say kind of 5+ years professional software programming experience to juniors, because you don't want to like overwhelm the seniors with a bunch of people they have to mentor. So again, maybe just a clarifying question, how many seniors were there in that unit? How many people there had at least, you know, 5, 8, 10 years of professional team programming experience?
Virtually none had 5 or above, because the way it works is that we have compulsory service of about 3 years. Most of the people who do software engineering and their military service sign up for a bit more. So you're there for 4, 5, maybe 6, but it's pretty rare to see people who serve for more than that without, you know, becoming essentially officers and get pretty far removed from hands-on work. And therefore, when I joined my first team, for example, I think we were a team of about 6 people. Out of them, 3 had less than 2 years of experience, and the other 3 had about 4 years of experience. And the person managing you there, we call them team leads, calling them an engineering manager, still seems far-fetched what we did back then, were usually people who were just slightly more experienced than you, like 2 years, maybe 3 more, and that's about it. And still, even though people were so green, they learned. And, you know, this was early 2000s, but we were all over using stuff like test-driven development and talking about Agile and having all the copies of everything the pragmatic programmers have talked about, etc. So we were really at, I believe, at the forefront when it comes to software engineering best practices. But we all had to learn it by ourselves really, really fast without having too much to rely upon.
So what were some of the things that were put in place? I mean, is this just simply a matter of saying, well, if you don't get it right, lots of people are going to die, so figure it out? Or were there also systems, processes? Was there a culture? Like, what was it that it stopped this from being a train wreck?
Yeah. So I believe that, first of all, we had those constraints. You knew that there's virtually no one that can save you. There's no hero. In many startups that you come to, even at later stages, there's this founding team that serves like this sort of a engineering Batman. Whenever there's an issue, there's an outage, someone makes an old system break, they appear out of nowhere, they, you know, all of a sudden they're in the Slack, they're fixing it, and they off they go after that. You have those people. We very rarely had those because, again, this is compulsory service, but once you're done, you're done. It's not like the person is there just in a different floor. They're not there. If it's really, really bad, you can get sort of something like a bit like a warrant to ask them as a reservist to come. But, you know, this is going to take hours, days, weeks. It's not something that you could just call the phone, and it's not something you can talk about on the phone because this is classified material. So they have to actually go there, etc. It's a big deal. So, first of all, the constraints just made you be so, I believe, so mindful of what you were doing, which really helped get quality to a level that's rarely seen. And second, we had a lot of agency, as in I knew that if I had an idea, if I had an approach, I would be listened to. I still remember that as a corporal, I was sitting in a room and a lieutenant general there was saying, we should do this, we should do it that way, whatever. And I just listened and I had an idea and I saw why his approach didn't make a lot of sense. And I just, you know, I said that. There's no, especially in the Israeli army, there's no saluting or whatever. We just talk directly, basically. So I just said that and no one reprimanded me. No one was angry. I wasn't out of line. They just said, oh, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And I think that that really lets you get your creativity juices flowing. And lastly, we had what I now call product mastery, and that is you're really connected to what you're doing. I wasn't just getting Jira tasks and doing whatever the specs were saying. I really understood my users. I was in constant contact with them. I understood what the system was doing, even if I was integrating with something that was very complex and I didn't necessarily understand all of it. I understood the purpose of everything. And that meant that I could come up with my own ideas of how to solve things. When users had a need, I could really understand what was needed or cut corners to get to the impact faster. And all of that together really worked out. And this is not something that's unique, I think, to the Israeli army, but it is something that I've seen happen in only very little places before. For example, someone once told me that the original team of one of the Apollo missions, you know, what was the average age of people in the control room? Less than 25. It is possible to have people responsible for things that are really complex without having 8, 7, 10 and more years of experience if you allow them to learn faster. We seem to be coddling people too much. And I believe that imagining that something takes 3 years of experience is just because that's what we've gotten used to. And people can learn a lot faster if you create the right atmosphere and you help them do what's nowadays called deliberate practice. We actually let them do things that are different. They're not just doing the same rote tasks day in, day out. They're not essentially coding on autopilot. They're always engaged. They have in front of them the exact objective of what they're aiming for. This is not just I'm trying to complete my sprint, but I'm trying to help us get to that intelligence destination or get to that business outcome or whatever have you, so that people actually understand it and become an integral part of a team, not just a highly paid code monkey or code ape.
So I got to ask, I mean, this obviously tracks with so many things like Dan Pink, the book Drive, right? Autonomy, Mastery, Purpose, and the idea of being product driven or customer obsessed. So it all tracks really well with a lot of the advice. And yet this is not necessarily the default state in every engineering team. What are some of the things you think we do wrong, especially as our orgs get a little bigger? What do we do that disempowers our junior developers? What are we doing wrong?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, we tend to be overprotective, either because as, you know, you get your first EMs or you make people EMs for the first time, they tend to be very overprotective. I think this is a natural instinct. They just want to make sure that they're doing well and people feel like this can fail, right? It's not possible. This is my first time doing this, or this is our first quota, or whatever. Nothing can go wrong. And therefore, I have to make sure that everything works. This isn't micromanagement per se. This is about just, you know, listening to all the little decisions, making sure that you're aware of what's happening, helping them a bit too much, letting them rely on you a bit too much, and you're essentially serving as a crutch for your team. This is one. And the complement of this is that if you're managing managers, you have to help them see where failure is something that we can tolerate and even welcome. So if we don't have any room for failure, if any delay in a sprint or in a quarterly objective is translated in your manager's minds as something that's a complete disaster or, you know, something I'm going to be reprimanded for, et cetera, they are going to default to their safe mode. They are not going to let anyone try things out for the first time if they can help it. They are going to make sure that whoever is senior is on top of things, whoever is junior essentially remains a junior, because we're not letting them do anything that's too complex. And therefore, they learn a lot less than they are able to. And we need to unlock this. We need to stop talking about deadlines as if someone's gonna be dead if we don't get there on time. This is something that I always talk about. Let's define how critical a deadline is. When we have, you know, a release date for August 1st, Is it because there's a huge conference and we have to be ready? Or is it just because, you know, it looked like a good date, but we can move it a week or two if needed? We need to talk about this so we know when deadline is rigid and when it isn't. And when it is rigid, let's talk about what genuinely would be a failure and what would just be, okay, those are a bunch of nice to haves that we didn't get to. And once you do that, people lower their guards and can actually let others learn a bit faster. They can let people experiment and do things that are not always guaranteed to work out as fast as we hoped, or might not work out as at all. But that's fine, because we're letting them do this. And if you don't do this, you're never in the deliberate practice zone. And people just barely learn, barely experiment. And for me, this was one of my early memories as, you know, again, a programmer, we didn't use the engineering term, was that I got to do so many things for the first time. And I asked online, I tried to find someone else in the organization that had some experience. Maybe I picked up the phone to ask someone that I knew who I didn't knew even, you know, face to face, someone that I had a record of written. They served here X years ago, and I can ask them something like a, you know, a syntax question. I can't ask them anything that's classified, but on the phone I can say, you know, how do you use this sort of framework here, or would you use this or that sort of stuff? And we did that. We learned little by little, but, you know, like compounding interest, because I had so many of these so early, I got to learn faster. And I also, something that was ingrained in me is the fact that I am supposed to, and I'm capable of learning fast. There's no expectation put on you by the organization. You know, you see this when I work with public companies that have all of these very, very strict levels. People know they're not going to be going for a promotion from level X to X plus one before they're there, usually for at least a year or two, whatever. You just expect to not learn as fast. You expect to take longer to do things. But if you're free from this, or if you know that those who shine genuinely can go as fast as they're capable of and no one's going to be stopping them, you let that talent really come out. And it's possible. It's a bit harder to manage. I get that. But I do believe it's worth it.
So that it's really interesting trade-off, because on the one hand, if you've got a team that is investing in deliberate practice, you would expect their productive capacity to grow more quickly. So theoretically, your capacity for delivering business value should increase more quickly. But the flip side is you actually need kind of some slack for that kind of first half of the track in terms of giving them the space to make the mistakes. How do you think about the payback period on that? Presumably, you can look at the kind of area under the graph in terms of like business value delivered and say, well, so if it takes them this number of months are making this number of mistakes, but then at this point in time, they're now going this much faster in terms of your stories per week or whatever it is. Do you have any sense as to what the payback period is, or how to think about how and when and whether to invest in this as a company?
Yeah, I think that once you get to a stage that you have, you know, once you've crossed the 20, 30, 40 level of amount of engineers in your organization, it no longer makes sense to just aim to get seniors and seniors and seniors. I've seen people who try to keep doing that, but it just means that people are going to be growing a lot less fast. And also, you're going to be paying quite a premium because you're only getting people who are already there, in air quotes, as opposed to helping brilliant talent grow in-house. And once you get there, I agree. There's something here about balancing the short-term delivery and the long-term growth and the pickup of the delivery and velocity of the team. But to do that, to balance it, I try and have teams so that in every, you know, pizza-sized team of 5, 6, 7, 8 people, the majority are seniors slash mid-level, and you usually have only a junior or two within any such team, so that the team is basically capable of delivering 80% of what it is committing to, even solely just counting on the people who are not junior in the team. And my aim is to have these juniors be out of junior mode. Usually by 6 months, they should be, you know, on the cusp of being a mid-level, if this is someone who's genuinely a junior. And a year into the role, usually they should be pretty independent. They might still be asking questions, not know everything when we're talking about user architectural decisions, they consult, etc. But they should be pretty autonomous when it comes to their day-to-day. And if you've ever watched Peter Pan, there's this thing about Peter Pan and all the kids, they're never growing older, right? They remain juniors forever, the lost kids, the lost boys. And I sometimes do this exercise with my clients where I say, let's do a Peter Pan count. Let's open the org chart. And I want you to tell me for every single person who's a junior and who's been in the company for at least 6 months, let's talk about, have they made this sort of an evolution? Do you see them actually progressing? And too often, again, we have this self-imposed belief that you take 2, 3, 4 years, whatever, to go into senior. And that's fine when it comes to the level. I'm not talking about the compensation right now. I'm talking about the experience and the ability to deliver impact. And I want to see people making leaps in every quarter when they're just starting, because, you know, if you look at someone like, I don't know, Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player in the world right now, he's not making huge leaps in his ranking every month because it's virtually impossible. He's at the top of the game. But if you're looking at someone who's just learning how to play chess, they're supposed to be seeing a lot of progress month in, month out, because they have so many low-hanging fruit. And we need to see the same with our people. And if you don't see that, help them. Let your senior engineers see how mentoring and coaching others is actually part of being a senior engineer, and how that actually benefits both parties. And this is something that also I saw as, you know, later on in my service, when the new recruits were coming in and I already felt like I knew it all because I had 3, 4 years of experience. And when I actually had to sit down with people who had this fresh perspective, and they would ask me, but why are you doing this? And why does this make sense? And why not do it that way? I kept learning or understanding better what I already knew. And this actually helped me learn again and learn new things and learn them at a better level. Just like, you know, sometimes when you watch certain movies a few times, you pick up new things every time. And I saw the same whenever I was talking to new recruits, whenever I had to go through the same onboarding conversation, those sorts of things. And I think that we can all get this sort of a win-win if we do this as part of our cultures.
And I think that makes a lot of sense, right? In education, there's the idea of like, see one, do one, teach one, right? It's the idea of, firstly, you watch somebody do it yourself, you internalize the skill, but you really start to master it when you have to communicate the intricacies of it to somebody else. And so that you both get better, and then you're also sharing the love within your team and bringing the next generation up. So that's fascinating. So this isn't really about, hey, you just need one senior and like 25 juniors sitting next to them, but rather
keep
a very low ratio of juniors, but just have a definition that an expectation that somebody should graduate from that in 6 or 12 months rather than 36 or 48 months. Mm-hmm. Now, with that expectation, does that impact the process of hiring? Are there specific things that you look for or hire for people who can keep up with that pace? Or is it simply pretty much anyone could do that, and it's just our fault for not allowing them to grow fast enough?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. So I think, first of all, you have to look for this when you're interviewing, when you're hiring, because you want to see people who have this sort of a growth mindset. If you ask them about something they don't know, they don't feel like, oh, I'm supposed to know this. But they're capable of saying, I don't know, but you know, here's how I would try and find out. Here's what I would try and do. Or I believe I could learn it in this amount of time. And even if the answer is far-fetched, I want to see this mindset of it's possible. And actually, when I got enlisted and we had the first couple of months of training, on the wall was this big poster that said, anything is possible. And, you know, that's a cliche, et cetera. And we used to joke about it. But I saw how this got ingrained because we just had a habit of whenever you're, you know, someone comes up with a new need or there's a new crazy deadline because of some operational need or something like that, before we as, you know, senior cynical engineers just shoot it down, say, no way, it's going to take 2 months, we need to hire more people. We started with the suspension of disbelief. Let's assume this was possible. Let's assume we are able of doing it. If that were the case, what would we have to do to get there? Or what would have to be the situation? And, you know, sometimes you realize, okay, it really is impossible. But other times you get to do things that are mind-blowing. And that's how, you know, small teams with 19 and 20-year-olds did things regularly over there in my unit that are, you know, equivalents in the NSA. You had a bunch of PhDs, teams that were 10 times the size, budgets that were 100 times the size, I'm guessing. And we were sometimes doing things they couldn't even imagine because we had to be scrappy and we had to come up with new ways of doing things. So you're looking for that. And this is something that only in retrospect I realized was something that the recruiters for my unit in the Army were looking for. And that's something that I'm teaching my clients about. How do we sense this in conversations? We're not looking for those who already know it all, but those who have this hunger to learn anything if you just let them and just move out of the way. And also, this almost never works. You know, this is like tango. And it almost never works if you just get these people who are eager to learn and told them to learn without the proper mentoring and coaching. So again, we talked about the seniors who need to teach it, but also your EMs in your company have to be getting enough guidance about how to be an effective coach, how to be an effective leader. And this is, you know, I don't want to get the wrong impression. Not everything back there was amazing. Not everything was perfect. For example, being a manager there was something that you get, I don't know, like 2 days of training a year. And it's like, you know, one day you're just an IC, the next day, oh, boom, you're a manager, you have six people under you, good luck. And you'd get virtually no coaching from your manager, essentially a commander, again, you know, different ways of saying things. But still, I keep saying just because we had to work really hard to learn how to manage back then doesn't mean that you have to do the same right now. And I see it with a lot of people who are now senior leaders because they had to teach themselves how to be managers, how to be leaders. And they just assume that that's what everyone should be doing. They have new managers and maybe you get a week of training or something like that, but that's about it. You know, essentially you're on your own. But no, if you want to have this sort of a culture where people learn really, really fast, their managers have to understand what this is all about. They have to learn how to push people when needed, how to hold someone's hand when needed, and how to structure their time so that they actually maximize learning, maximize experimenting, while balancing, again, the deadlines and everything. So you need to, your hiring has to have both the hiring for people with the growth mindset, but also making sure that the hiring managers are the right people to make the most out of these precious people you find.
So I guess two things just to get super tactical. Do you have any questions that you particularly enjoy using in an interview to kind of try to capture that growth mindset?
Yeah. So I usually try and ask, these are questions where there's no right and wrong, you know, a definite answer. But I try and use something that's really hard just to see what the other person thinks, how they think, how they approach something that might seem impossible, etc. So I try and take things, usually they are, you know, from the news recently. So in the past year, for example, I've been using, you're now one of the EMs at Twitter, now X. And the team is basically, I don't know, 5% what it used to be a year ago. What does that mean? Like, if I'm hiring EMs now, that's what I'm asking them. What does that mean for organization? How would you have to operate differently? What were you used to in different companies that you cannot assume is just happening right now? And again, I'm not saying that's how I want to structure an ideal team, but I want to see how they approach something that might sound, oh my God, how do we do it? Or you know, right now, Facebook, Meta, they have the new Threads system, a network. And they started with a very small team. If I remember correctly, it was like 50 engineers, which is very small when you're talking about something that got to, I don't know, 100 million users in a month. How would you approach that if you were the engineer responsible of the mobile app, of the backend, of I don't know, getting search to work, whatever. I want to ask these things that are almost impossible to think about, you know, on the spot in an interview, but I want to hear how they would approach it, what their instincts are. Do they just, you know, go into lockdown mode and think, oh, that's impossible, I can't do it, isn't it the right role for me? Or are they trying to come up with ideas? And usually, by the way, we're talking about letting people realize that failure is fine from time to time in work. I also make sure that we communicate this in the interview. When I'm asking you this question, I'm not assuming you should have the answer. Clearly, you know, virtually no one has done something similar in their past. And therefore, unless you're one of the, you know, dozen or so people who were on the team that did something similar in the past, you're not supposed to have the textbook solution. I want to see how you're thinking, and that's fine. We're not looking for, you know, this is not one of the questions on in Google's interviews where there's a precise algorithm you're supposed to know. And once we do this expectation setting, you sometimes see people realize and actually get really into it. But if that doesn't happen, it means that likely they are not the types of juniors I want to bet on, because again, I'm only betting on 1/2 in every team per year. And those are precious, precious spots for me.
And then if that's how you go about identifying the juniors you want, are there any things that you do to identify the right kind of leaders, the right kind of EMs and team leads who will provide the mentorship required to make the system work?
When it comes to promoting people, you know, people who were ICs into management roles, my default thinking is that if you want it and if you're interested in it and you had a good track record as an IC, it usually means it is possible to be a good leader. The question is it something that you really want to do? Because some people do it and realize that they missed technical parts, or they don't like all the meetings, et cetera, so actually what I try and do with my clients is help them have these sorts of almost like, you know, guided meditations. Let's think together what the engineering manager role means in this company. How would your week probably look like a year from now? How should you be spending your time? How we measure in this company, in this organization, whether a manager is doing their job well. And once we talk about how an average week looks like, or what are the common issues you're probably going to be seeing, what success would mean for you. Success wouldn't be you're swooping in to save people in an outage. Success is, how do I create a team where people know how to collaborate when there's an outage? They're not pointing fingers when something bad happens. They're trying to work it out together, that sort of stuff. So I'm talking about this, and I want to see how the person reacts, just like in the interview question before, and I want them to think about it. And usually when we're talking about getting someone to try a managerial role for the first time, I advise them to have this sort of, let's think about it, and then take a few days to just let it stew. I want to see after this whole talk about how your ideal week looks like, after all of it has sunk a bit, I want to see if you're still interested or hopefully excited to try it out, or do you realize, maybe that's not for me. Maybe this is a person that should be advancing on the IC track, which is also great. But once you've heard it, and I'm not trying to hide it from you, let's talk about what are the tough parts of being a manager. If you're into it still, I'm always defaulting to let people try, give them the coaching and management they need, and hopefully they're going to learn that this is a whole new profession that they like and that they want to keep doing. Or maybe, okay, didn't work out. Luckily, there's still a bunch of other things we can do around here.
We're almost out of time, but if an engineering leader was thinking about kind of moving towards this process of kind of accelerated growth for their juniors, what would you say some of the first steps would be moving from a legacy organization?
So first of all, I think that this all boils down to what we started with. People need to be able to get the agency. So you have to, as a manager, be okay with letting go. Notice your default responses. When someone asks a question, do you default to giving them the answer, or do you default to asking them, you know, what have you tried? Or what would you consider? Or what do you suggest? Or who did you talk to first? And, you know, this is a bit of being an annoying person when someone wants an answer, but it is also, you know, teaching them to fish, right? And you start with that to give people more agency, let them see that they can and are expected to come up with solutions on their own. And the second part is to create this product mastery so people actually understand what they're doing. We're not talking about GR tasks, we're talking about objectives. Because only when people have the entire context and they really understand it, can they come up with, oh, this might be an interesting experiment, not because I saw this article on Hacker News and I want to try this framework, but because I understand what's at stake, I understand where we're aiming, and I also have this context of different things I want to try, or I've never touched front-end code before and I want to do it in this sprint if possible, etc. Once we have that, you start pushing people to this thinking of experimenting as possible. And depending on your role, if you're an EM, talk to your manager about the definition of what's a failure in the company. If you're a VP, a director, let's make failure something that you can embrace. Okay, I'm not talking about no one cares about what we reach at the end of the quarter, but about the fact that, you know, sometimes in order to learn, we have to make mistakes, and that's fine. So let's talk about that. Let's make it part of our jargon at work. Did you have a healthy failure this quarter? Let's normalize not being perfect.
Aviv, thank you so much for taking the time to share your wisdom and experiences.
Thank you.
If you'd like to learn more about Geeks Who Lead, go to geekswholead.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter to get regular access to other great interviews, and then see whether you might qualify to join one of our exclusive free executive communities.